A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us two questions that I think are sharper than they first appear. First, what actually impelled Toyota to become the dominant force in process optimization, beyond the usual hand-waving about Japanese culture? And second, which other companies have made equally profound contributions to process methodology that don't get the same spotlight? The second question is the one that really interests me, because I suspect most of us can name Toyota's greatest hits, but draw a blank on who else cracked a genuinely new problem.
And that's exactly the right framing, because Toyota's story isn't a story about a company that decided to get good at process. It's a story about a company that was staring at extinction and had no other choice. Post-war Japan, 1949, Toyota was essentially broke. They produced fewer than 3,000 trucks since the war ended. Ford's River Rouge plant could produce 7,000 vehicles in a single day. Toyota couldn't afford inventory, couldn't afford floor space, couldn't afford rework, couldn't afford to have anything sitting around waiting. American automakers could buffer every problem with stockpiles and extra capacity. Toyota had to solve the problems.
So the famous Toyota production system wasn't born from philosophy. It was born from being too poor to be sloppy.
And that's the part that gets lost in every business book that treats TPS like a set of techniques you can photocopy. Taichi Ono studied Ford's assembly lines extensively. He visited the U.S. in the 1950s, and he didn't come back thinking American manufacturing was stupid. He came back thinking American manufacturing was optimized for conditions Toyota would never have. Cheap capital, massive volumes of identical products, a domestic market that would absorb everything you could build. Japan's domestic market in the 1950s wanted small volumes of many different vehicle types. Trucks, small cars, commercial vehicles, all in limited runs. Ford's system was designed for millions of identical units. Toyota had to figure out how to build variety without sacrificing cost or quality, and they had to do it with no money.
So the constraint wasn't just poverty. It was poverty plus variety. That's a fundamentally different problem than what Detroit was solving.
Right, and that's why the core insight of TPS isn't be efficient. The core insight is that flow is the goal. If you optimize for flow, meaning the work moves continuously from raw material to finished product without stopping, then every problem becomes visible immediately. A machine breaks, flow stops. A part is defective, flow stops. You don't have inventory to buffer the problem, so you have to fix it right now. American manufacturers in the same era could just route around problems, a defective batch of parts, pull from inventory, keep the line moving, deal with it later. Toyota couldn't do that, so they had to build a system that surfaced problems instead of hiding them.
This is where the and-on cord comes in, right? The thing where any worker can stop the entire production line.
And that's the perfect example of how TPS is misunderstood. People hear any worker can stop the line, and they think it's about empowerment, about respecting workers, about Japanese collectivism. It's not. It's a mechanism for making problems visible the instant they occur. On a Ford line, if a worker spotted a defect, they'd note it and it'd get fixed later, or more likely, it wouldn't. The line kept moving. The problem got buried under inventory and rework stations downstream. At Toyota, pulling the and-on cord stops everything. A light goes on. A team leader comes running. Everyone sees the problem. And that visibility is the entire point. You can't improve what you can't see.
And the counterintuitive part is that this actually increases quality and productivity, even though you're stopping the line constantly. Ford's logic was that stopping the line is the worst thing that can happen.
And that logic makes perfect sense if you've got a system designed around buffers. If your entire operation assumes you'll have defective parts and rework stations and inventory to absorb variation, then stopping the line really is catastrophic. It cascades through everything. But Toyota eliminated the buffers, so stopping the line became the only way to prevent defects from compounding. And here's the really elegant part. Once you stop the line, you're forced to fix the root cause, which means that problem never happens again. Over time, the line stops less and less. Ford's approach meant the same problems recurred forever, because they were never truly solved.
So the end-on cord is basically a pain amplifier. It makes problems hurt enough that you actually solve them.
And this connects to something that's often glossed over, the 1950 financial crisis at Toyota. The company was so cash-strapped that it shut down for 90 days. Massive layoffs were on the table. The union fought it, and the eventual settlement was a landmark labor agreement. Toyota promised no layoffs ever, and in exchange, the union agreed to total flexibility in work assignments. Workers could be moved to different tasks as needed. That agreement created the trust necessary for workers to pull the end-on cord without fear. If you think stopping the line might get you fired or get your coworker laid off, you don't pull it. The no-layoff guarantee made TPS possible.
Which means the social contract wasn't a nice-to-have. It was a prerequisite for the technical system to function.
And this is where W. Edwards Deming enters the story. Deming was an American statistician who gave a series of lectures on statistical quality control to Japanese engineers in 1950. His core message was that quality problems are almost always system problems, not worker problems. If you blame the worker, you never fix the system. Toyota absorbed this deeply and integrated it with what they called respect for humanity, which wasn't HR rhetoric, it was a production principle. If you respect workers, you design systems that make it possible for them to do good work, and you trust them to surface problems. The end-on cord embodies all of that in a single physical mechanism.
Let me test the cultural argument against the Nummi story, because I think that's the killer evidence.
Nummi is the definitive proof that TPS isn't culturally Japanese. New United Motor Manufacturing Incorporated, 1984. General Motors had a plant in Fremont, California that they'd shut down in 1982 because it was their worst plant in the entire system. Absenteeism was over 20%. The parking lot had to be cleared of beer bottles every morning. Quality was abysmal. Labor relations were toxic. GM and Toyota formed a joint venture to reopen it. Toyota would manage the plant. And here's the crucial detail. They rehired the same union workforce, the same UAW local, the same people who had produced GM's worst quality.
And within what, 2 years? It was producing Toyota-level quality.
Within 2 years, the same workers were producing cars with defect rates comparable to Toyota's Japanese plants. Productivity doubled. Absenteeism dropped to around 2%. The workers who had been considered the problem turned out to be perfectly capable of world-class manufacturing when the system was designed to support them. Toyota sent American workers to Japan to train in TPS. They came back and implemented it. The system transferred completely.
So the Japanese culture explanation collapses the moment you look at Fremont.
It collapses completely. And it also reveals what TPS actually is. It's a teachable system. It's not mystical. It's not about national character. It's about specific mechanisms, standardized work, visual controls, the end-on cord, just-in-time material flow, continuous improvement through problem visibility. You can teach those things to anyone. The hard part isn't the techniques. It's the commitment to surfacing problems instead of hiding them. That's the cultural shift, and it's organizational culture, not national culture.
All right, so Toyota solved the problem of waste in a resource-constrained environment by building a system that makes problems visible and forces you to solve them at the root. But then the question becomes, who else cracked a different problem just as thoroughly?
And this is where it gets interesting, because the other companies that made major contributions were solving completely different failure modes. Let's start with Motorola and Six Sigma, because the origin story is almost as counterintuitive as Toyota's. 1986. Bill Smith, a Motorola engineer, is looking at field failure data, and he notices something that shouldn't make sense.
What?
Products that had fewer defects during manufacturing were failing more often in the field. The conventional wisdom said better manufacturing quality should mean better field reliability. The data said the opposite. Smith realized what was happening. The defects that were caught during manufacturing were the visible ones. The products that passed inspection with flying colors still had hidden defects, what he called latent defects, that wouldn't show up until the product was in use. And because those products sailed through manufacturing so cleanly, nobody looked deeper. The inspection process was screening out the obvious problems and letting the subtle, catastrophic ones through.
So the better your inspection looked, the worse your actual quality could be. That's a terrifying insight.
It's a complete inversion of conventional quality thinking, and it led Smith to the insight that became Six Sigma: you can't inspect quality into a product. The only way to eliminate latent defects is to design processes that are incapable of producing them in the first place. This was a philosophical break from what was then standard practice. The concept of acceptable quality level, or AQL, which literally accepts a certain percentage of defects as normal. AQL says, will allow 3 defects per 1,000 units. Six Sigma says the only legitimate target is 0.
And the 3.4 defects per million number, that's the marketing version, right?
That's the number that got branded and sold. Six Sigma's actual contribution isn't a defect rate target, it's the shift from measuring acceptable quality level to measuring process capability, what statisticians call CPK. Instead of asking how many defects did we produce, you ask how capable is this process of staying within specification limits. If your process is capable, defects don't occur. If it's not capable, you're just sorting good from bad after the fact, which is inspection, not quality. The methodology, Motorola formalized, DMAIC, define, measure, analyze, improve, control, is a structured approach to making processes capable. Motorola saved something like $16 billion over 20 years using it.
And then Jack Welch got hold of it at GE in the mid-90s and turned it into a global industry.
1995, Welch made Six Sigma mandatory across all of GE. And this is a fascinating case study in how a methodology spreads beyond its origin. Motorola invented Six Sigma to solve a specific problem, latent defects in electronics manufacturing. Welch applied it to everything from jet engines to financial services. The methodology generalized, but it also got diluted. The version of Six Sigma that most companies implemented was a pale shadow of what Motorola built, because they adopted the certification structure and the tools without the underlying commitment to process capability thinking.
So, Six Sigma's origin story is basically our inspection was lying to us, so we had to build processes that couldn't lie.
And that's a completely different problem than Toyota's. Toyota was fighting waste from buffers. Motorola was fighting invisible defects that survived inspection. Different failure pattern, different solutions.
Now, Lincoln Electric. This is the one I find almost unsettling, because it feels like it shouldn't work.
Lincoln Electric is the most radical example of process optimization through incentive alignment that exists. 1914. James Lincoln implements a piecework system where workers are paid for each piece they produce, no cap. But there's a guaranteed hourly minimum, so you're never punished for things outside your control. And then there's a year-end bonus tied to company profits. The bonus has, in some years, paid out more than 100% of base salary. Workers effectively double their income.
And the result is that workers redesign their own tools and workflows because they directly benefit from higher output.
That's the mechanism. Most process optimization is top-down. Engineers design the system, workers execute it. Lincoln's system makes every worker an optimization engineer. If you figure out a way to produce more pieces per hour, your pay goes up immediately. If you spot a workflow bottleneck, you have every incentive to fix it. The company hasn't had a layoff since 1958, which creates the same psychological safety Toyota built with their labor agreement. Workers know that improving productivity won't eliminate their jobs.
And this has been running continuously for over a century.
Continuously. Through the Depression, through wars, through recessions. The system survived because it aligns individual incentives with company goals so completely that they become indistinguishable. The worker who figures out how to produce more isn't just helping the company, they're giving themselves a raise. And because the bonus is tied to overall company profits, there's peer pressure against anyone who might try to game the system at the expense of quality. If you produce junk, the company's profits suffer and everyone's bonus shrinks.
So the social enforcement is built into the compensation structure.
Right. And this reveals something about process optimization that most methodologies miss. Toyota and Motorola focused on the system, the flow, the statistical capability, the visibility mechanisms. Lincoln focused on the human. Their insight was that the people doing the work are the best source of process improvements, but only if their incentives are aligned. Most continuous improvement. Programs fail because they ask workers to optimize for the company without optimizing for themselves. Lincoln solved that problem at the root.
Which brings us to Hewlett-Packard and the HP way. This one is less formalized, less famous as a methodology, but I think it belongs in the conversation.
It absolutely does. Bill Hewlett and David Packard's contribution wasn't a named methodology like TPS or Six Sigma. It was a recognition that process optimization requires information flow that formal reporting structures actively block. Their mechanism was management by walking around, MBWA. The idea was that managers should spend significant time on the factory floor and in the labs, talking to people, seeing what's actually happening. Not in scheduled meetings, not through reports, but by being present.
Because the filtering of hierarchical communication strips out the ground truth problems.
A problem that a line worker sees every day might never reach a vice president if it has to travel through three layers of management, each of which has an incentive to report good news. MBWA short-circuits that filtering. The HP way also included things like open plan offices, first name culture, profit sharing, but the core insight was organizational. The information you need to optimize processes exists at the point of work and you have to go get it. You can't wait for it to come to you.
And if you look at all four of these companies together, a pattern emerges that I don't think gets enough attention. None of them were trying to create a methodology. They were each solving a concrete problem that was killing them.
That's the unifying thread. Toyota was solving the problem of waste in a capital-poor environment. Motorola was solving the problem of latent defects that inspection couldn't catch. Lincoln Electric was solving the problem of misaligned incentives. HP was solving the problem of information filtering. Each company's methodology emerged from a specific failure pattern, not from theoretical purity. And that's why applying these methodologies as if they're interchangeable is so dangerous.
Say more about that. What happens when you apply the wrong methodology to the wrong problem?
If you apply Six Sigma to a problem that's actually about flow and buffers, you'll spend months measuring process capability on a system that fundamentally can't flow. You'll optimize individual steps without ever seeing that the real problem is the inventory pileup between steps. If you apply Lean to a problem that's actually about latent defects, you'll eliminate waste beautifully while your products keep failing in the field, because you never address the hidden failure pattern. If you apply Lincoln-style incentives to a system where workers can't actually control their output, say, a process that's bottlenecked by a machine they can't modify, you'll just create frustration.
The methodology has to match the failure pattern.
And the failure pattern has to be honestly diagnosed. That's the hardest part. Most organizations don't want to admit what's actually broken. It's easier to adopt a branded methodology and declare victory than to look at your own system and say, we're hiding problems with inventory, or our inspection process is lying to us, or our incentives are rewarding the wrong behavior.
So what's the practical takeaway for someone who's not running a factory, but wants to apply these insights?
Start by identifying your specific failure pattern. Not, we need to be more efficient, that's too vague. What's actually breaking? Is work piling up between steps? That's a flow problem. Toyota's approach applies. Are you catching errors but still having failures downstream? That's a latent defect problem. Motorola's thinking applies. Are people not improving their own workflows? That's an incentive problem. Lincoln's insight applies. Is management unaware of what's actually happening on the ground? That's an information filtering problem. HP's approach applies.
And if you can't identify the failure pattern, that itself is a failure pattern.
That might be the most important point. If you can't see what's broken, your system isn't making problems visible. That's the Toyota insight at the most fundamental level. Before you adopt any methodology, you need a mechanism for surfacing what's actually wrong. The Andon cord, the statistical process control chart, the profit-sharing bonus, the manager walking the floor. These are all different mechanisms for the same purpose, making reality visible.
Which brings us to the uncomfortable question. What are we missing right now?
This is where I get curious. The history of management is full of unsung innovators. We know about Toyota and Motorola and Lincoln and HP because their methodologies got branded and sold. But how many companies have solved specific process problems brilliantly without anyone packaging it into a methodology? The constraint is that successful approaches get turned into products, consulting practices, certification programs, book franchises. The original problem gets forgotten, and the methodology becomes the product.
So the next great process, optimization approach, probably already exists inside some company that's solving a specific problem right now, and we won't recognize it until someone packages it and sells it back to us.
That's my suspicion. And the test for whether a methodology is genuine or just branding is whether you can trace it back to a specific failure pattern it was designed to solve. If the origin story is consultants developed this framework to sell to executives, it's probably hollow. If the origin story is, we were bleeding and we had to stop the bleeding, it's probably real.
The misconception I want to name is the one that treats Kaizen as being about continuous small improvements. That's the surface. The real mechanism is visibility. Kaizen works because it creates a system where problems can't hide. The improvements are a side effect of making reality impossible to ignore.
And the companion misconception is that these methodologies are culturally bound or industry specific. NUMMI proved TPS transfers across cultures. Six Sigma went from Motorola's electronics manufacturing to GE's financial services. Lincoln's incentive system has worked through a century of economic change. The common element isn't Japanese culture or manufacturing context, it's the willingness to look honestly at what's broken and build a system that fixes it at the root.
So, the question Daniel's prompt leaves us with, and I think it's the right question, is what other companies have done this work without getting the credit? And more importantly, what problems are being solved right now that will become the next generation's Toyota production system?
The history of process optimization is really a history of companies that ran out of options and had to think differently. Toyota was broke. Motorola's products were failing mysteriously. Lincoln Electric needed to align worker and company interests in a high-skill manufacturing environment. HP wanted to prevent the bureaucracy they'd seen at larger companies from strangling innovation. None of them set out to create a methodology. They set out to survive.
And the methodologies that emerged were just the documentation of what worked.
Which means the most interesting process innovations happening right now are probably invisible to us. They're inside companies that are too busy solving problems to write books about it. Someone, somewhere, is reinventing how work works because they have no other choice, and in 20 years we'll be doing episodes about them.
Something to watch for. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone who's still using acceptable quality level as their standard. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.